A Philosophy of History, Part 3. The third talk in a series, Issues in a Biblical Worldview, was presented by David Crabtree on May 19, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
My advisor today was talking about Nietzsche's astute observation that is the nature of human beings to go to car races. Nietzsche didn't use the example of car races, but my advisor did. They go to car races not to see who wins, but to see who crashes. And so this is your chance tonight to see me crash. I'm going to do a daredevil act here and try to, in 1 hour, go through the history of the world and hit all the high points. This is Krang. I talked about Krang last week, my new visual aid, I guess, of what man is like. I think this is a wonderful, wonderful little image. And here we have, this is Krang, he's the brains of the outfit. But he is a helpless little fellow. He can't even get in here without someone lifting him up and putting him in here. But once he gets in here, then he's got this beautiful body that he can manipulate.
Or at least.
this body that he can maneuver and accomplish great things. And that's how a man sees himself. That's what man is constantly trying to do, is to get himself into one of these hulking bodies so he can step on things. Wonderful, wonderful little words. Okay, I'm going to be working at a level of generalization that is mind-boggling. If we just finished Sunday mornings at my place, a group of us have been watching Francis Schaeffer's 10-part series, How Should We Then Live? And I remember when that first came out, hearing the critique of people who had gone to see it, saying that he oversimplified. And I come away from something like that and say, well, how could someone not oversimplify? I mean, here he is taking the history of Western civilization and trying to reduce it to 5 hours. Well, there's a great deal of simplification that has to go on, generalization, that sort of thing, that has to go on. The charge of oversimplification is an easy one to make. That's going to be true tonight as well. The charge of oversimplification is going to be very easy to make. I've been working on this, trying to get this right as I can get it at this point in time. And I'm not extremely happy with it, but I think in general it's going in the right direction. But there are a lot of the specifics that I don't know, and that's something that's kind of a lifelong task before me, to try to put together a lot of the details and specifics. But this is just something that I am presenting for your consideration. As you will recall last week, what I'm arguing is that history is an account, the history of the world is an account of man's attempts to liberate himself from his finitude. That human beings are frustrated by their limited capabilities. We have the appetites of gods, but very limited powers. And so man is constantly trying to figure out how to tap into various power sources to accomplish his ends, that is, to find satisfaction, fulfillment of his godlike appetites. And so human beings are always in the search of power sources, and the power sources, I think, can be reduced to just a few. That is, power sources as it's seen by the world, The first is brute force. Let's say there's a large boulder here. I don't want that large boulder here. One thing I can do is pick it up and move it. So brute force is one power source. And the second one is money. If I can't lift it up, but I have money, I can hire someone else who's stronger than I am to pick it up, or someone else. Third is technology. Knowledge is also power. I may not be able to pick up the rock, but if I'm smart enough, I can work out a lever that I can move the rock with. Fourth is spiritual forces. If I can't move the rock, I can pray that some God will move it for me. Okay, I am conceiving money as a distilled form of power. If we start, for the most part, these forces are used one person with another. And we can translate all of these into that arena. Lenin said, all of politics is someone getting punched in the snout. The question is, who does it to whom? The only question is, who does it to whom? And when it comes down to it, history in general, and human relationships in general, it's who does it to whom is the question. And these are the different ways that it can be done. Brute force, I can get someone else to do what I want them to do, or remove them, or whatever. I can apply pressure on them by brute force, by money. I can hire someone else to come in and thump on them, or I can starve them out. Money can be used in a variety of ways. Knowledge. Well, I suppose with knowledge, you're informing them. But there is another thing that needs to be taken into consideration here, and that is that, for the most part, human beings have decided that these forms of power are greater through cooperation, through joint action. Thus, the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel was the discovery that cooperating together, using technology, using knowledge, people could accomplish a great thing. So, as long as we can derive more benefit from joint action than we have to give up from our perspective, then that's the route that we will go. Okay. I'm going to use these categories as I talk about history. Brute force is going to be military and the state. Money is economics. Knowledge, technology, and spiritual forces and religion. Okay, here's my survey of world history. I'll put the dates whenever I know them. Most of them I don't know. Paganism. Paganism was an interesting early development in the history of man, because in paganism there are lots of little gods that are accessible to me as an individual and manipulatable by me as an individual or a group. So they are not very powerful, but they can be manipulated by my group. Second event, 9.2, the agricultural revolution. In the agricultural revolution, people started to raise crops, and this made an enormous difference in the way people lived, in that they were able to eat better, they were able to stay in one place, and the ability to stay in one place meant that you could now have the accumulation of things. You could now have more than you could carry. You could develop land, you could build houses, set up irrigation, you could build roads, that sort of thing. One of the books I read, it said that the two most significant events in all of human history were the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution. And I can see why someone would argue that. Third event, development of money.
Even though you're not placing dates on these, are you implying chronology?
Yes, these are roughly chronological. Since these first ones were very difficult to place dates on volume. The development of money, this is of extreme significance. If I am a farmer and I raise a bunch of wheat, I can use some of that, but there's a limit on how much I can use for my own personal use. So the rest I have to trade to someone else in my community. But there's a limit on how much I can trade in my community, and I can't keep it forever. Eventually it will spoil, it will turn bad, unless I have some way of storing it for a long period of time. And I can only trade it to someone who needs wheat. If they had a good crop, I can't use it. It's an item of trade. Money, it can be saved over a period of time, and it is universally acceptable, universally negotiable. Everyone can use more money. So I can accumulate wealth, and I can exchange it for virtually anything, including labor. The development of money becomes very, very significant. Writing. Writing allows for the accumulation of knowledge, but the knowledge from past generations can be recorded and passed down. So now we have a means by which a great deal of knowledge can be accumulated. It is also significant in terms of making possible organization and administration of government. In fact, that's apparent, but the first use of writing is the government administration. Fifth thing, Israel wanted a king. Israel was originally a theocracy, but in 1010 they requested a king like all the other nations. This is significant because what they wanted, what they say in the biblical account, what it says is that they wanted someone who could lead them into war and someone who would establish justice. I think reading between the lines, what they wanted was some person, someone that they could address, someone that they could see in their midst, someone who would empathize with them, and someone that they could talk to reasonably. So government then among the society, in the midst of society. I'm going to go through and tie these together to them according to category. Next thing, Moses and Socrates. I'm going to give the date for Socrates. I'm not sure that Socrates is the best person to pick out here for this, but the idea is monotheism. The concept of monotheism, I think, was crucial in Greek culture for the expanding of knowledge. Prior to the time period that roughly corresponds to Socrates, the idea was that there are a vast array of gods that act like human beings and are in constant conflict one with the other, such that the events on earth are attributable to the goings-on in the soap opera of heaven, of the divinity. And as a result, it was very difficult to make sense of human existence. But starting with Socrates, the Greeks begin to think in terms of one guiding spirit behind reality. And then you can start speaking in terms of coherence of reality. Now you start talking about a consistency, predictability. And I think that was a crucial ingredient to get Greek philosophy off the ground. The next man is Constantine, 320-330. This is AD. Constantine declared Rome to be a Christian. Well, he declared Christianity the religion of the Roman Empire. And so here we have a significant event in that historians have pointed out that Christianity was the first multinational religion. It's the first civilizing religion, is the term that my advisor uses. That before Christianity in the Roman Empire had grown to include areas where a vast variety of gods were worshipped, but they were local gods. Christianity was able to override those. The God of the Bible was, in a sense, an international God in the form of Christianity. And as a result, it was something on a unifying force that could be built on. And it was a unifying force for an empire that included a lot of diverse peoples. But there's another factor here, and that is we have the fusing here of religion with the state. That's not entirely new, that had happened before. But here we have a civilizing religion that is an international religion that is fused with the government state. 1200, we have gunpowder. Gunpowder was discovered by the Chinese. I don't know if I've mentioned some of these oddities of history, but the Chinese were very inventive. Gunpowder, paper money, first clock. Paper itself, spaghetti. There are a lot of things that we take for granted and don't think of as having their origin in China, and yet they did in fact come from China. But one of the remarkable things is that the Chinese didn't make practical application of a lot of these discoveries. They used gunpowder for fireworks. The clock they discovered, but they never really used it for anything. The printing press. The Chinese developed the first printing press, but it didn't have movable type, and they had different alphabets in it, and the characters that stood for words instead of sounds. But the thing that Western culture has excelled in is finding practical application for these kinds of things. Gunpowder. Someone from Western civilization who sees gunpowder says, aha, weapon. When a person from Western civilization sees a clock, they say, aha, navigation. Clock was essential for developing navigational skills for sailing around the world. Without the clock, it would have been very difficult to navigate around the world. The Chinese discovered the clock at the beginning, and there are a number of discoveries that could be listed like that. But the genius of Western civilization was to find practical application for any small discovery. Gunpowder is an excellent example. And gunpowder turns out to be something that can be used for Western civilization to come to dominance over the entire world. I have read some accounts of the Russians moving through Central Asia after they have an army with some of the first guns. And you read the accounts, it's just unbelievable. You have these armies of 20 or 30,000 of the natives attacking 100 Russians armed with guns. And the casualties will be 5 or 6,000 of the natives dead and maybe 2 Russians injured. It's just unbelievable. But gunpowder transformed warfare. And one of the ways that it transforms it is that it becomes killing at a distance. Now, there had been some killing at a distance before with arrows and that sort of thing, but here it's primarily killing at a distance. And bravery becomes less significant now. Strength. So warfare is beginning to be changed dramatically. The next event, 1517, the Reformation. The Reformation was a very significant development in Western culture and therefore the whole world, because with time, Western civilization, Western culture becomes the world civilization, world culture. And that starts at about this time with some of these occurrences. But in the Reformation, a significant change in the way people look at God and religion. And the thing that is becomes significant about the Reformation is the fact that I, as an individual, have a responsibility to determine the nature of truth. So now it comes down on the individual to decide what is true. And as time goes on, there are a couple of directions in which that is taken, but that's a very significant change. Capitalism. I don't know what date to put on that. Capitalism is a very strange development. The notion that money can be used to make money. And it was a concept that was not really very significant in times prior, but for some reason, at about this time after the Reformation, capitalism becomes a dominant notion in Europe, the idea that money should be used to make money. And I think that a lot of part of the reason that capitalism came into being to a large degree prior to the Reformation. But with the Renaissance and the Reformation, we have a change, and now the concept is that your status should develop, should depend on merit, what you accomplish. And one way a person can demonstrate merit is by making money. So capitalism kicks off. 1649, English Revolution. English Revolution is a strange phenomenon. There's a revolution in which the Puritans overthrow the king and then end up beheading him, putting him to death. This is a bizarre situation because prior to this, the concept had been a king ruled by divine right, that a king's authority comes from heaven. It was most strongly taught in France, but it was essentially the idea behind monarchy throughout Europe. But in England, people beheaded the king, and then he was not replaced. And the thing that's really interesting about that is people begin to say, his authority doesn't come from God. Because we can behead him. We can behead the king. We can kill the king. By killing him, he has no power. That authority for government rests in the people, ultimately rests in the people. The next moment, 1770 is the date I will give to it, is the Industrial Revolution. I have probably mentioned earlier, and I've been struck by the significance of the Industrial Revolution. It really did transform the world, and it started by transforming Europe. And I will take a little bit, I'll do this as quickly as possible. Europe went through this enormous disruption. It was like a cataclysmic event when the Industrial Revolution got going. Because Europe was changed from an agrarian society to an urban, modern urban, industrialized society over a period of about 100 years. And it was very disruptive to society as a whole. But Karl Marx argues that the way that human beings look at the world is dependent upon the economic relation. I think that he is ultimately wrong on that, that there is something more fundamental that affects people's worldview, but I can see how he came to that conclusion by looking at the world around him. If I am a peasant farming, my well-being depends on forces that are under no human being's control to a large extent. Not completely obviously, but to a large extent. My well-being depends on how the crops grow, the weather, bugs, that sort of thing. And if I have a bad year, the chances are, in industrialization, there's a very different dynamic taking place. You move into the city. Now, my well-being depends on the price of my product that you produce. And that the price of that product is dependent upon social forces. My well-being, and this is a perception, my well-being is dependent upon what other people do, and that can be manipulated by politics. So the result of the Industrial Revolution, just some of them, are politicization of all of society. Now we have the beginning of mass politics, whereas before politics had been, that's what the elite do, that's their job. But now the politics becomes a concern to everyone. We have mass politics, we have urbanization, we have secularization. God is no longer as significant as he used to be. For the peasant, God was very significant. God controlled the most important forces. Move into the city, work for a factory, God becomes less important. On the farm, the peasant's relationship to his cow was not all, that cow was not just a means of production. There is also, in a sense, a personal relationship between the farm and the cow, because the cow has personality and it's inescapable. But as I'm working in the factory, the machine has no personality. I'm convinced that Marx was seeing something that is very true, that the transition from an agrarian society to the factory changes the way that people look at things and even see the world look at it. 1789, French Revolution. Here's where we see a revolution that grows out of industrialization. This is a revolution in the character of the time after industrialization. It is very secular. It is a secular revolution. It is very much the product of mass politics. It's people in the streets. It's mob. Jacques Ellul wrote a book called The Autopsy of Revolution. And he argues that the French Revolution is a complete departure from any revolutions and revolts that occurred prior to it. And it has set a pattern for revolution since. What he argues is that all revolutions prior to the French Revolution were backward-looking revolutions. They wanted to restore a time past when things were right, but that the French Revolution was a forward-looking revolution that wants to bring into being a society that's never existed. And that since then, revolutions have been of that, of the French Revolution type. They tend to be social revolutions that want to bring in a utopia. They want to bring in better times. So it is different in that it is ideological, and that ideology is forward-looking, and it is organized revolution. Organization is not a part of revolution. It doesn't strike you as backward-looking. It is in that they were basing their claim on English law, English constitution. It's not a written constitution, but the way English government is done. What they were arguing was King Charles had deviated from English tradition. That was not the case in the French Revolution. They weren't arguing that Louis XIV had deviated from tradition. They were saying it's a new thing that ought to happen. The Bolshevik is definitely forward looking. The American Revolution is before this. And the American Revolution is also backward in the same way that the English Revolution is. The American Revolution was saying, making a similar claim as we had in the English Revolution, that the King George is deviating from the English Constitution. That is the way English government operates. There is a sense in which it's reactionary. Right. There is innovation that takes place. But what Ellul is arguing is that at heart, it is reactionary. The way it developed, there is some innovation that takes place. But at essence, it's reactionary. The French Revolution, at essence, was forward-looking. It is significant that there was a lot of sentiment for establishing a monarchy, but it was not a reaction against monarchy. It was a reaction against arbitrary rule. 1883, death of God. Someplace in this time, God died in Western culture. I have picked this day that Nietzsche talked to Nietzsche and suggested God. But in the intellectual life of Western culture, as a result, partially as a result of the Reformation, one stream from the Reformation was, if it is my responsibility to decide what is true, I can decide that God does not exist. That is the dominant stream in Western intellectual culture, is that God is not relevant. God exists, God is not relevant to the humanity. I think what I'm going to argue is human beings liberating themselves from these various constraints as they see them in all of these areas. 1914, the date I'll give, is World War I and World War II. It's a development of total war. That is a time in which there is a blending of civilian and soldier, and a blending of war and peace such that they are no longer distinctly different. In the world wars, it's societies that fight against societies, not armies that fight against armies. The front line, there is no front line anymore. So we bomb Dresden, and they bomb London. We bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Civilians, soldiers, it doesn't matter. They're all contributing to the war effort, because the war effort, war has changed through industrialization, through technology. The whole society goes to war. The whole economic system goes to war against another society. And we have developing here a weapon that has the potential of destroying the whole world. 1936, Keynesian economics. Here, Keynesian economics, the state now becomes involved in the regulation of money, the manipulation of the economic system. A very quick example of this that I just heard about in Japan, the head of, well, their equivalent to our Greenspan, he tightened up the money supply such that prices fell. And he did this for a very specific purpose. He wanted to allow, he was afraid that Japan was splitting into those who have and are able to buy a house and that sort of thing, and those who can't. He wanted to do some leveling. So he choked off the money supply, forcing prices down on property, and now the younger generation can now, for the first time in their lives, buy houses. But that was accomplished essentially by taking from the rich and giving to the poor, by manipulation of the money. I don't know what the date put on this, but the development of the world market, tightly networked world market and multinational, there is something that is tying us all together, all over the world, whether we like it or not, and whether we're aware of it or not, and that is economic ties that are being developed, which mean that if something goes bad in Tokyo, with the economics there, it affects us here. If something goes bad in London, it has an effect that ripples throughout the world. We're being closely tied together by these economic ties. And the last thing that I will mention is in the realm of technology, and that is virtual reality. There is, I don't know much about this, but there is technology that's being developed that allows people to experience something that is so real that it is like you're experiencing something on a monitor or on a screen, and you can react to it almost as if it is the real thing. So for instance, flight simulators have been around where pilots train on it, and they can, without going up in the air at all, they can have the experience of going up in the air. And I heard about a fellow who went down to the Bay Area. He's a firefighter. And they have some kind of device where they put on this helmet and they can experience everything that you would experience at a fire situation. And you make decisions in certain ways, and that affects what you see and where you go and all that sort of thing. And using these devices, they can train a fireman in a matter of 4 or 5 weeks to the level that they would have been trained using normal methods in a year, because there aren't that many fires for them to experience in a normal situation, but through this virtual reality, they can have that every day. Okay, now those are my top, whatever it is, top 18. And I'm not sure that I have picked them out, I'm not sure that I've made the best choices, but the pattern that I am seeing is one in which human beings are constantly trying to liberate themselves from constraints that are on them, such that they can use their power, increasing power, in ways to better their lives as we see it. So for instance, in the area of military and state, there's an increase in killing power as you go down. More force, more potent force. They can be used at longer distances. You can kill them without conscience because you don't see them, etc. War becomes more deadly, more impersonal, more distant. There is also the state, as I'm conceiving of it, is also a force. The state, as the king comes down and is among us, can be influenced by us. The English Revolution, he can be beheaded. He's ultimately within our power. We put kings there and take them down. That's certainly the lesson of the French Revolution, that it's the masses that decide who will rule. So the power of the state has become in the power of us. It's not from God, it's us. We are the state, we are the power. I suspect that where it's going to go from here is in the direction, it's what the Greeks had always warned about, that the worst form of government is a tyranny of the majority. Something that democracy, decentralization of power absolutely required is that the people have a concept of what is best for the whole. In the back of their mind, as they make decisions, that must always be a significant factor in the decision making, what is good for the whole. I remember when I was in France, just before an election, I was reading a magazine, and there was just an interview with some man on the street. This man on the street said democracy will never work in France, because Frenchmen will never be willing to give up their short-term pleasures for the long-term good of the whole. The short-term personal pleasures for the long-term good of the whole. That's very perceptive. That's essential for democracy to work. The trend that we've got here, the decentralization of power into everyone making their own decisions based on what they personally would like. In the field of economics, we have the concentration of wealth becomes almost a living thing. Marx describes capital as almost this living thing. Well, money does become this force, it's distilled power you can carry around in your pocket. With the development of money, then capitalism, you have to use that money to make money. And that creates this treadmill in which entrepreneurs have to keep improving their process, increasing their efficiency and their productivity. And this competition creates a situation in which everyone has to play the same game. Everyone has to be expanding, producing more efficiently, becoming more productive. But that economic force, the Keynesian economics, is merged with the power of the state and with the world market. It becomes an international force, which is at the same time very precarious. Economics have become very, very powerful. They've brought us a lot of things that we like, but it's like a stack of cards. It wouldn't take much to bring it all down. Technology, we've made great strides. The agricultural revolution was harnessing nature. The industrial revolution and scientism which followed it was improving on nature. Virtual reality is replacing nature. So in technology, we're trying to liberate ourselves from the constraints of the cosmos, if only gravity didn't affect it. And in religion, it is a trend towards what I've described up to this point is a trend towards a God that we can control, a more powerful God, as we move from paganism to Constantine, a more powerful God, but we want him to be a manipulatable God, and a God who makes no demands on. That's the God we would like. That is the direction that I see, that what mankind has done is over time, for the sake of power, mankind has sold his soul. And in order to justify it, has created unreality. We are more and more divorced from reality. And I think that the moral of the story is we will decide that the latter is probably even worse than the former. My guess is that the world will end on this note. All that mankind has done that we have thought of as progress hasn't got us anywhere.